Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the show. It's an ensemble show, lots of good people involved. And the host of the program, its founder and guiding light, is Carol Marx. Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she is indeed a champion in the battle against ageism. On today's show, she'll be talking with Adam Braun, the founder of Pencils of Promise, an award-winning nonprofit organization that has built more than 200 schools around the world. And he's going to talk to her about the project and his new book. But let's kick the program off now with Carol in conversation with a fascinating individual, Ira Judelson. He's one of New York's most prominent bail bondsmen. He's going to talk to Carol about his new book titled The Fixer, The Notorious Life of a Front Page Bail Bondsman, published by Simon & Schuster.
Isn't being a bondsman one of the oldest professions on this planet?
Well, first, what I do is I lend money to people that are incarcerated to get them out as quick as possible. I secure my bonds with collateral to ensure the court that they're coming back. And I put the package together with family, friends, loved ones, and sometimes bosses. And yes, it is one of the oldest professions around.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your personal life, because I think it's fair to say that you failed at a wide variety of careers until you learned your real talent was being able to hustle. So why is that important, and didn't that discovery lead you to becoming a bail bondsman?
Well, that's absolutely correct. You know, as a young man who graduated college with a degree, who thought he was going to find a job in the world at that time, I struggled. I worked for some different places. I tried to open up bars, nightclubs. I tried to put my hands in as a sports agent. I threw 100 things against the wall. Nothing was sticking. I got very depressed at a young age. Didn't understand what depression was back then, 25 years ago, sat in my parents' home. They repoed my car, and I tried to figure out the world, and it was very difficult. My world turned a little upside down when an old high school flame came to my parents' home to trick-or-treat with her three children. And she asked me if I was going to the high school reunion, and I looked down, and I had no job, living with my parents, no car, and I figured out that I really didn't have too much to say at the reunion. So, yes, the life turned around a little bit, and I got involved with some different things, trying to earn a living, and then kind of stepped into becoming a bail bondsman and learned that my great-uncle happened to be in the industry. He took me on, took a chance on me, and we took it to a whole new level.
And you certainly did. Now, rappers have been among the clients that you've arranged bond for, and one rapper you helped was DMX. His real name is Earl Simmons.
Earl Simmons,
so,
yes.
Yeah, and what charges was he facing in 2004, and was he someone who just couldn't keep himself out of trouble?
Earl Simmons, a.k.a. DMX, happens to be a phenomenal guy. Just got hooked on some bad things and got involved with some parking tickets. And with the parking tickets, it grew and grew and grew to a lot of different what they call scoff laws. So a judge gave him ample amount of time to put everything together, and Earl just couldn't get it together. So he had some issues, didn't understand his court dates, was trying to travel and do some things to make some money, and missed his court dates. We ended up working everything out with Earl, and you know, he had some issues later on down the line with driving again with suspended license after, you know, the parking tickets and some speeding violations. He spent some time incarcerated in different states. I stayed in touch with his wife, who happened to be a beautiful woman. His children are good people, and you know, they later on divorced and tried to put some things together. And I know he had a reality show, and I hope he's doing great. I happen to like him. He had a fantastic career while he was doing good. And we had a good relationship, and I wish him nothing but the best.
And there you go. And I thought one of the stories in your book about him was really crazy.
Yes.
And that was what happened when he crashed your niece's birthday party.
Yes.
At a mall.
Yes, Earl had been out on bond with me, and we had some paperwork and some money issues to reconcile. And Earl always had a little bit of a time management problem. So I said, Earl, I can't seem to make it today. You were supposed to be here yesterday. And he ended up not showing up 2 days in a row, and I was on the way to my niece's birthday party up in Danbury. Earl said, where are you? I said, I'm going to my niece's birthday party. Where? I said, Danbury. He says, I'm going to meet you there. And the next thing you know, I heard people screaming and yelling in the mall. We were in Build-A-Bear. My niece was a young girl. And here comes Earl with his whole family into Build-A-Bear with a birthday party going on with tons of toys that he probably went next door to Toys R Us to get. And his family sat in on the birthday bash, and the mall went crazy. You know, people were screaming and yelling. Earl was a big figure back then. He ended up staying, and we ended up talking. He met my family, he met my niece Callie, and he met my brother Barry, and so forth and so on, and my sister-in-law Ellen. Plus, he already knew my kids, and you know, it was a nice day. He's a good guy. A lot of my clients I build relationships with, Carol.
Absolutely. Now, one of them that I don't think you built a great relationship with, but she certainly is a high-profile person, and that was Lindsay Lohan. So what was she like to work with? And don't you think, Ira, that there's too often a mindset among successful entertainers, mobsters, executives, sports stars, that no matter what mess they make, someone from their entourage will clean it up and they don't have to be responsible?
Well, I mean, listen, they're in a whole different world. They're in a world of fame. They're being paranced around. They have different groups that surround them. And that's part of, you know, my book. I have in there some tips on what to do and what not to do when, you know, excuse my language, when things go down. And, you know, the biggest thing I say is, you know, you got to surround yourself with good people. And if you surround yourself with good people, then people will put you in a positive light. I believe that in my family life. I believe that in my professional life. And, you know, a lot of these people don't surround themselves with the right people. It's a lot of yes people. And if you get a lot of yes people when you do something wrong, eventually the walls are going to start coming down. And you know, in what I do for a living, people need me. They come to me at their most vulnerable times of their lives. They're scared. They don't know what to do. And that's where I step in.
Now, Ira, you said it's tough to say any one client made your career. So what made you say the $5 million bail bond you wrote for Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who was the managing director at the time of the International Monetary Fund, who was accused of sexual assault and attempted rape of a chambermaid in a midtown New York City, what makes you say that getting his bond was a real game changer for
you? Well, you know, getting involved in that type of case with the notoriety that it brought all over the country. I mean, this gentleman possibly could have been the French president. And, you know, dealing with such great attorneys on the case and helping Dominique and obviously his wife who came in from France and put that bond together. It's a large bond. It's one of the largest bonds ever in commercial state bonding history. And, you know, getting him out, getting him home, and then eventually getting him exonerated of all his charges. I don't really know what happened on the civil case. I was never privy to that. You know, having that bond and, you know, and for the world, what people don't understand in that case was it didn't make a difference whether he was guilty or not guilty at that point. For 1 week straight, the phone calls and the people that were following me all over the place from my home to my office was, when is he getting out? It didn't make a difference when he was going to Greece to possibly bring money over there. It didn't make a difference if he was able to go home. It was when was he getting out and if he's getting out. So the world came to a halt. And, you know, I make a joke about it in the book. When I was out to dinner that night on a Saturday night, I happened to be with my wife, and who happens to be a bondsman's wife, but my soulmate, my best friend, and understands what it takes to be a bondsman's wife because you're really a doctor on call 24/7. And she, somebody said, Ira, I got to take this phone call. Oh, I jumped outside, and it's Ben Rothman's office, and he says, listen, this went down, and they tell me who it is, and I got to be quite honest with you, Carol. I didn't know what the IMF was. I thought it was a bowling league.
Oh.
So I stepped aside and I started putting the bond together.
And you said that his wife was beautiful and very elegant, and she was an heiress and a prominent French journalist. And you know, I was intrigued, as I think most of the world was, when they read when she was asked why she did put the bond together for her husband. And what did she say? Because I still find that hard to believe.
Well, you know, she happened to be beautiful, and she was elegant, and she was classy, and she just looked at me, and she basically said, you have to stand behind your man, and in the nicest terms, and believe in his, you know, his innocence. And I did. You know, I said, I really don't want to know. It wasn't my business. But, you know, when you get into my profession and what I do, and the biggest thing that people have to understand about The Fixer, the book, is that bondsmen all over the country have a very tough job to do. And they work very hard at what they do. In New York, being a bondsman is a little bit more difficult sometimes because we have to go in front of judges and deal with a lot with the district attorneys, where in other states you go straight to the jail to do a bail. And, you know, when you go in front of that judge and that DA, you want respect from the other side. They want to make sure the defendant's getting back to court. They don't care whether or not we're making a fee. They just want to ensure the court that that defendant will be there.
That's what the whole thing is about, showing up for your court date.
Absolutely. That's important. And it's important for me because the respect I have on the other side, the relationships I have with DAs and judges is very important to me because those DAs eventually go on the other side and become defense attorneys a lot of times. Judges eventually, you know, leave the bench and do different things. And it's important that when I walk into a courtroom, it settles down.
Ira Judelson, in conversation with Carol Marks. His book is titled The Fixer, The Notorious Life of a Front-Page Bail Bondsman, published by Simon & Schuster. And his website is irajudelsonbailbonds.com. In case you need to be bailed out, check it out. irajudelsonbailbonds.com. Carol Marks returns in conversation with the founder of Pencils of Promise. That's next. When A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here on this great talk radio station in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. Here's the host, Carol Marks, in conversation with Adam Braun, founder of Pencils of Promise, an award-winning nonprofit organization that has built more than 200 schools around the world. His new book is titled The Promise of a Pencil, How an Ordinary Person Can Create Extraordinary Change, published by Scribner.
Now, I think we become who we are largely because of the way our parents raised us and the circumstances we were raised in. Your grandmother survived the Holocaust. The rest of her family did not, and she later married another Holocaust survivor. One of her children was your father. So is it fair to say that you inherited your parents' strong genes of giving to charity and taking the road less traveled?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely what happened. You know, I had a strong sense of the lineage that I came from, knowing that my dad's side was two Holocaust survivors. On my mom's side, both of her parents really lifted themselves out of poverty, and my mom grew up, as did my dad, without really much at all besides a loving family and kind of moral and civic values. And, you know, my earliest memory was actually the second night of Hanukkah. When as a kid, rather than getting a second night of, you know, amongst eight nights of gifts, the second night my parents actually sat us down, and said, look, we actually are not giving you gifts tonight. You're going to pick, an organization. We're going to make a small contribution, a charitable contribution to that organization in your name. And, you know, as a kid, it's kind of tough. Like, you want that, you know, that gift. But, it was really important for them to instill philanthropic values in us. And I think that was really impactful within my upbringing, and it's a lot of the work that we do today at Pencils of Promise. The organization that I started is helping children come together with families, you know, building relationships with their parents, and teaching those philanthropic values from one generation to the next.
Now, getting back to your life and choice of work, what field did you want to work in when you were in middle school, and what kind of jobs did you have? Because at that point in your life, you weren't really thinking about starting a nonprofit organization.
Correct. Yeah. When I was a kid, I became obsessed obsessed with Wall Street. Like, literally, it's all I could think about. I really wanted to work on Wall Street. I just, you know, I wanted to be really wealthy because I thought that that would bring happiness into my life. And I also was a big basketball player, and, you know, I saw some of my friends' parents who were, you know, living in mansions, and other friends of mine and teammates of mine that were living in the projects, and it seemed like the people that were living in the biggest houses worked on this thing called Wall Street, and I was good at math and competitive, and I thought it was the right place for me to be. And so when I was 13, I opened up an E-Trade account. When I was 16, I started working at a hedge fund. When I was 19, I was at a fund of funds, and I was on this fast track to a Wall Street career while always kind of starting little businesses, because my parents said, you know, we'll support your travels and whatever you want to go do, just not financially. So you're going to have to make your own money if you want to go out and see the world. But, you know, we're going to be supportive of you along the way, but it's up to you. So I always had this kind of entrepreneurial spirit. And then when I was 21, I went into the developing world for the first time and had a habit of asking one child in each country that I went through one question, and that was, what do you want most in the world? And have them write it down on a piece of paper. And I thought I'd get these kind of collections of global interests, you know, a house here, a boat there, a car there. And much to my surprise, I met this boy begging on the streets of India. And I thought, you know, what would a street beggar want if he could have anything? A kid who has absolutely nothing. And his answer was a pencil. And I gave him my pencil, and he just lit up. And I realized that there was so much wisdom in that request, because the single greatest thing to unlock a child's opportunity is greater access to education. And yet we live in a world where literally 57 million children every single day don't have access to any form of schooling. And so I just became incredibly inspired and found a sense of personal purpose in that mission of education for all, and eventually left what was a dream job at Bain & Company to start Pencils of Promise with $25 just before my 25th birthday.
But don't you think, looking back on your life, that it was very important that you worked at a for-profit company?
Immensely.
Because,
yeah,
because what did it, it teaches you to be successful in working, and you don't call these social organizations nonprofit. You call them something, I think, which is terrific, for-purpose organizations. How did that help you get your dream fulfilled?
Well, you know, I found that in a lot of ways there are people who have tremendous passion and they really want to create positive change in the world, but if they don't approach it with a real commitment to results and a sense of business acumen, oftentimes they either don't get the, you know, kind of impact that they want to see, or they have unintended negative consequences. And you see it all the time, especially in the developing world. Somebody comes in trying to be helpful, and they end up actually hurting the community more than they're helping it, just unintentionally. And so, you know, it was immensely important. It's probably one of the biggest things that makes not only my approach, but ultimately the work of Pencils of Promise different in this charitable space, is that we're run with the head of a great for-profit and the heart of a nonprofit organization with a humanitarian mission. And we're a 501c3 organization, but, you know, we're really clear about almost the economics of it. It's only $25,000 for us to build and sustain a full school. I mean, literally an entire school that changes a village and hundreds, if not thousands, of lives over the next several generations. But I just never liked the term nonprofit. I don't think that anyone gets into the space to nonprofit. They get into the space to actually increase the profitability of the lives of those in poverty, or to increase the sense of purpose in their own. And so I just think that the industry needs to reconsider its language. And instead of calling this work nonprofit, I like to call it for purpose.
I do too, because, and I think it will help people that are running for purpose organizations
totally
to earn a decent amount of money, and you will have more people coming into it. I just did want to mention one thing, because I think it's a, I haven't seen the movie, but after reading about Baraka, isn't that movie a wonderful way for people to learn about what's going on in other indigenous cultures around the world? And it's a great way to open your eyes.
Totally. I saw that film, Baraka, when I was a sophomore in college, and it just completely, it literally changed my life. I mean, I sat there for whatever it was, about 2 hours, just mesmerized, because it just shows the beauty and the kind of differences of all of these indigenous cultures around the world. And it also just displays, you know, Baraka means blessing in different forms, in different languages, and it just makes you feel so blessed to be a part of this existence and want to make sure that you're, you know, helping the world in some capacity to, you know, get to a better place. And you know, that's a big part of just the reason that I wrote the book, is because I found that I had all these lessons that I had learned over building Pencils of Promise from $25 into what is now more than 200 schools around the world. We have more than 25,000 students in our programs every single day. And I just felt like I had learned so much that I wish somebody had told me earlier on. And I started to meet all these people who were just at a place where they felt a bit restless. And that could be, you know, because they were an empty nester and their kids had just, you know, moved out of the home. It could be because they were entering a second or third part of their career. It could be because they were about to graduate from college or high school. But they felt restless and they were entering a period of, you know, desired transition. And that's what I went through. And I had learned all these things. And so I wrote this book, The Promise of a Pencil, How an Ordinary Person Can Create Extraordinary Change. And as I'm sure you read, each of the chapters is not a traditional chapter. They're all titled with mantras. And those mantras are really the guiding steps to create a life of success and significance.
And I want to ask you about your website, where people can learn more about the work that you are doing and what your plans are for expanding your program. I love the fact that you're giving more students scholarship programs and training teachers.
So the website to learn more about the organization is pencilsofpromise.org. If you want to learn more about a little bit of my story and the writings, I continue to blog and post, and there's plenty of videos of speeches and different content at adambraun.com. My last name is spelled B-R-A-U-N, adambraun.com. And the book, The Promise of a Pencil, is available in Amazon and Barnes & Noble and retailers nationwide. And the organization is really committed to expanding within our existing countries, so really focused on Ghana, Guatemala, and Laos. But it's about more than just building schools. And so we train teachers, we provide student scholarships, and we're also testing out the future of what technology can be in the classroom through what we're calling our innovation pilot. So it's a really exciting time.
And finally, what's the difference between charity and philanthropy? And if you had to say, what's your definition of a good life?
Oh, great question. So in my mind, charity is about a one-way distribution system, one way. It's essentially giving handouts to others, whereas in my mind, philanthropy is about activating value on both sides. It's an invested commitment, and it's a partnership, and it's what really creates transformational change. And then my definition of a good life is one that's built with meaning, first and foremost. I just think there's nothing more powerful than finding a sense of personal purpose. The second thing is love, and then the third one is ultimately fulfillment. And that's the definition of a good life in my mind.
Adam Braun with Carol Marks. His book is titled The Promise of a Pencil, How an Ordinary Person Can Create Extraordinary Change, published by Scribner. A Touch of Gray continues in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray.
Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We've come to that point in the program where we peek behind the scenes and see what's going on, you know, within the gears and workings of talk radio. Kevin Casey is our senior correspondent, and he also is the vice president and executive editor of the trade magazine Talkers, which serves the talk radio industry. This is a holiday weekend, Kevin. I guess, what do you say, happy 4th of July weekend or happy Independence Day weekend?
Yeah, it is.
And at least, I guess this is one of those holidays where you can say happy as opposed to, like, Memorial Day. You know, you go, happy Memorial Day. Well, I don't know. You know, certain
things. Right, yeah, it's one of the, yeah, exactly. It's a somber occasion, so why would you say happy when we're talking about Memorial Day?
Right, but the celebration of the independence of our country and the signing of the Declaration of Independence is a pretty big deal. And in talk radio, I mean, you know, Thomas Jefferson is historically one of the most revered figures in this medium. If you were to do a real study, and we used to do this in the early days of Talkers magazine, a real study of who the heroes of talk radio are, you'd find that Thomas Jefferson always comes up in the top five, top ten of people that are really just, you know, Thomas Jefferson said it, it must be okay. Isn't that
right.
Interesting? You know, the founding fathers. And, I don't know. Do you think we have enough, rehashing, reteaching, study, investigation into what the 4th of July is all about, or has it really become just an excuse for soda, pretzels, and beer?
I think the latter. I think that most people don't think too much about what the 4th of July is about. I think it's a great opportunity for a 3 or sometimes 4 day weekend in the summer when you can go outside and enjoy it, as opposed to those lousy 3 day weekends in the winter, which aren't really that much fun. And I think that's what people look forward to be quite honest with you. I think most people don't. I bet if you asked adults, a sample of adults, I bet more than half would not know what happened on July 4, 1776.
They might even know it was 1776.
They might not. You
know,
right.
But that's interesting. You know, the old Jay Leno jaywalking routine where the premise is that the average person in the United States, in America, is not that aware of things that we should be aware of. And I personally don't think that those jaywalking bits were done in sequence. They probably interviewed a lot of people to get the real dumb ones.
Sure.
Then you put them in sequence. But I wonder, I call it the mall survey. If you were to go to the average mall in America and talk to 100 people picked at random, I wonder if more people knew what, say, the 4th of July meant, what happened on July 4th, 1776 in Philadelphia. I wonder if more people would be able to answer that, say, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. In other words, are we as a public in the United States becoming less aware and educated of politics, history, geography, science, the things that we should know as functional citizens? Do you think it's on the wane, or do you think it's the opposite?
I think it's on the wane. And, I I'm not trying to be – it's easy to be negative and say, people these days don't know anything like we did when I was young, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's true, and I think it's – it's not taught as much as it used to be. I think those were the sorts of things in the older American education system, things of my generation, definitely your generation, and definitely the ones prior to us, were taught these things by rote, and they had to know them, and you had to be able to say the first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence and recite it in front of the class. Those things, I believe, are largely gone by the way, have gone by the wayside.
What's so interesting is that, in spite of the fact that I tend to agree with you, I never fully know for sure these things, but I tend to agree with you that that's the case. On the other hand, we live in a time when most people have access to more information than any generation all the way back to the beginning of recorded history. Never has so much information been in the pocket, you know, literally, in your pocket. I mean, your iPhone or your smartphone is a magical box when you think about if somebody told you, 20, 30 years ago, you'd have this telephone that can plug into all existing data in the world, except for top secret stuff, of course, but even technically, if you were a hacker, you could. But basically, all information that you would get from all the libraries of the world is in this phone, plus it's a camera.
Yeah.
And it has, you can watch TV on it and watch movies. I mean, would you believe, you think it's something out of Star Trek, out of the 25th century?
Yeah, very true. Your statement that we have access to all this information is very interesting, because indeed we do. I mean, I can't tell you, it happens, how many times a week are you somewhere when someone asks a question, you go, I don't know, and then someone Googles the answer.
Mm-hmm.
It happens constantly, and it's a nice thing. It's slightly along the same lines, though. I think the problem with the current era is that we, as consumers of news and information, not the ability to research something on the moment,
mm-hmm.
but the ability to, as we consume news on a regular basis, we have a lot of information, but very little actual knowledge or understanding.
Mm.
It's my belief that most people have a very thumbnail understanding of what goes on in the world, and they'll read a paragraph of a news story. Russia sends troops to the Ukraine, blah, blah, blah. If you ask them, what's happening over in Russia? Oh, they send troops into the Ukraine. Well, what's it all about? I don't know. And I think that's the problem with all this information, is we have so much access to it now that we have a superficial knowledge of just about everything, but true understanding of very little. Mm. I'm afraid that's where we're headed if things continue to go the way it seems they have been over the past 10 or 15 years.
Fascinating. And never before has the collective knowledge of humanity been so much greater than the individual knowledge of each person.
Yeah.
That is, you know, there once was a time when there were wise men that knew everything in the world there was to know. And nobody ever did that, but there were people that came close to it. And that, of course, today is impossible. So collectively, as a human race, we have more information than we've ever had. Individually, we have less of a percentage of it in our minds per the amount of knowledge that is out there. And all of these equations have some kind of importance and interest in terms of the big picture. Well, we certainly just didn't even scratch the scratch on the surface, but it's been great talking to you. I hope that you and your family have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you again next week. That's Kevin Casey. Kevin Casey is the Vice President and Executive Editor of Talkers. It's a trade magazine and talk radio, and you can visit it at talkers.com to find out what's going on within the talk radio industry. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in a moment.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marx offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marx is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and it's time for us to be joined the rest of the way by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. And Steve Wiseman is going to be talking with Giada De Laurentiis. She's an Emmy Award-winning celebrity chef and New York Times bestselling author and the granddaughter of director Dino De Laurentiis. She's going to talk to Steve about the opening of her new self-titled restaurant, Giada, in Las Vegas. She's also the author of Giada's Feel Good Food, My Healthy Recipes and Secrets, published by Clarkson Potter.
I love to cook, I love beautiful women, and I like people with more energy than the sun. So when I get a chance to talk to Giada De Laurentiis, who is all of those things, I'm leaping at the chance. And she's with us right now.
Hi. How are you?
Terrific. Now, like, you don't have enough to do. You're opening a restaurant? What's the story there?
Yeah, I got bored, you know.
That's it, yeah.
Honestly, you know, I've always looked for the right spot for a restaurant, and although, yes, I am busy, sometimes in life when the opportunity comes, you've got to grab it. So I found the most unbelievable spot at the Cromwell Hotel with a view of the Bellagio Fountains, and I just could not say no. It was a two-floor parking garage, and I wanted to build my dream restaurant, and I did.
Terrific. What's going to be unique about this restaurant?
Well, first of all, we're located in the first boutique hotel on the Strip, so that in itself, we only have 188 rooms, so that in itself is a brand new sort of unique experience. I'm the only restaurant in the hotel, and we are sort of on the second and third floor with retracting windows that have a beautiful view of the Strip. It's as if you're suspended on the Strip when you eat here. Also, the first thing you'll see is sort of an antipasto bar and a pizza station, creating sort of a very homey feel to the restaurant. So I think what I wanted to really do, because this is my only restaurant in the world, really, I wanted people to feel like they were coming over to my house for dinner. And when you come over to my house for dinner, the first thing you see and smell is food. So I wanted to recreate those images, creating a very warm environment with sort of very neutral tones and the aromas of food and very comfortable loungy couches and dining rooms with unbelievable views and lighting. So I think we did a pretty good job at doing that.
You know, it sounds so great. I watch your show a lot, and often I'll watch it from the gym, so I feel a little better because I'm on the treadmill or the elliptical while I'm drooling, watching you make all kinds of wonderful things.
It's so funny. I hear that all the time. But aren't you starving once you get off the treadmill?
Oh, absolutely. I run out, but the food's never as good as yours. Hey, by the way, do you ever eat junk food?
I do, Steve. But I think I might have a different definition of junk food.
What's your junk?
Well, I mean, I love chocolate, so I will indulge in a lot of chocolate. Ice cream, gelato. I don't really eat candy bars.
Yep.
You know, I love, like, a chocolate bar, but just a single chocolate bar. And I think that probably the only candy I probably eat are Junior Mints when I go to the movies.
Do you exercise, or is your schedule just so hectic that it burns off whatever calories you take in?
No, I do exercise. I do a lot of yoga, actually, and I try to do it about 3 to 4 days a week. I paddle surf, but I do run around a lot. I mean, honestly, I'm on my feet an awful lot, and running around will sort of burn the calories.
The menu at your new restaurant, I assume it is going to be Italian with the antipasto bar and all. Any kind of specialty dishes you're thinking about?
You know, what I did with the menu is I really wanted the menu to sort of reflect family-style eating, which everybody can share the dishes. We have an antipasto bar with cheeses and meats and seafood and veggies, and then signature dishes like my lemon spaghetti with jumbo shrimp, my Tuscan ribeye steak with a fried egg on top, my pea pesto tortellini, lots of sort of traditional dishes and lots of iconic dishes that are very iconic to me.
Oh, that sounds great. How big is the restaurant going to be as far as seating?
Oh, we've got about 275 seats, so we're rather large, but we are the only restaurant in this hotel, and we eventually will be serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and brunch on the weekends.
Wow. Any new cookbooks in the works?
You know, my last cookbook came out in November, Feel Good Food, and then I have a children's series with a few recipes in the back that the fourth installment just came out, New Orleans just came out about a couple of days ago.
Well,
called Recipe for Adventure.
Well, it's terrific. I'm going to keep watching you on television and drooling for multiple reasons and hope to get out to your restaurant in Vegas. Good luck with it.
Come visit us, Steve. Thank you.
Giada De Laurentiis. I like saying that name. Talking to Steve Wiseman. And her book is called Giada's Feel Good Food, My Healthy Recipes and Secrets. Clarkson Potter is the publisher. And if you want more information, go to thecromwell.com. thecromwell.com. Steve Wiseman returns in our next segment talking about Medicare ID cards. That's next when A Touch of Gray continues.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
For almost every American worker, Social Security is part of the plan for a secure retirement. It's important to know how the program works. If you have questions, the answers are easy to find when you visit www.socialsecurity.gov. Use the retirement estimator to get a benefit estimate. Browse our frequently asked questions. You can even apply for benefits online. Visit www.socialsecurity.gov to figure out your retirement plan. That's www.socialsecurity.gov.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of this hour of our broadcast. And more conversation with Steve Wiseman, Stephen J.J. Wiseman, Esquire. He's an attorney, he's a prolific writer, and he's an expert on everything from healthcare to scams. As a matter of fact, he has a website called scamicide.com. He's written the book, The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall, and he's got a very, very important book about to be released that deals with identity theft. So let's talk a bit about Medicare ID cards. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, for our listeners over 65, I'll bet I could guess your Medicare number. And all you have to do is just give me your Social Security number, because believe it or not, your Social Security number is the same number that's used on your Medicare card. Now, a lot of companies used to use the Social Security number as an identifier. Actually, it used to be the number on your driver's license. In the military, it would be a military ID. Problem with this is that Social Security numbers are the key to identity theft. And having it on any kind of a card like that that is just generally used, and your Medicare card will turn up, you carry it with you, which means it can be stolen or lost. You give it to so many different providers, and again, that's more people with access to this information that can make you a victim of identity theft and really make your life very, very difficult. So it doesn't take the rocket scientist to know that this is a problem. And like I said, with driver's licenses, the laws would change, so you cannot use your driver's license, your Social Security number on your driver's license. But despite so many recommendations to change this, Medicare has not changed it. So the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the new deputy administrator, was testifying before Congress last week. And in fact, at one point, Representative Marsha Blackburn, who's a Republican from Tennessee, pulled out this giant mock Medicare card and just asked outright, why is the Social Security number still on the card? When are you going to delink it? Now, the representative from Medicare indicating that there are 70 different systems that deal with Medicare information that will need to be done. And the answer is, yeah, sure, it needs to be done. So their argument was at Medicare that they need more time and more money. But the bottom line is there have been recommendations from the Government Accountability Office. Congress has told Medicare quite clearly that they've got to change this. Hopefully they will, but hopefully they'll go beyond what is being done with just other random numbers. And one of the things they're looking into is using electronic card technology, smart cards, you know, like the credit cards with the built-in security chips that are used around much of the world, but not here yet. That's a whole nother story. As a matter of fact, the target identity thefts would not have occurred had you had these smart cards. So hopefully the thing to take from this is hopefully that Medicare will be making the changes they need. They'll be doing it to make a more secure card. But until that time, what we all have to do is make sure you limit the access that people have to your Medicare card. You'll be happier for it.
Thank you, Stephen J.J. Wiseman, Esquire. And again, folks, check out scamaside.com to find out about all these dangerous things out there, especially on the Internet, that Steve Wiseman will protect you from, or at least tell you how to protect yourself. Steve Wiseman, thank you, senior correspondent on our program. Thank you, Kevin Casey. Thank you so much to Beverly Santinello, our producer on the front line, and a great thanks to Carol Marks, the host and founder of this program. I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us right here next week for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups.